Yeah, thanks for the invitation, it's really great. Okay. So, assume you all know about the LHC. Been doing a lot of great work there, very successful program for many years. Where we've been colliding protons at 13 TeV centers max now. And my day job is usually on the Atlas detector, where, as you know, we've been a very successful experiment understanding the standard model, finding the Higgs boson, and looking for new physics. Unfortunately, as we've looked for things like SUSY and also more exotic signatures with Atlas, as you know, all we've done is set limits. I like these slides because they're a little outdated from 2017, but I gave this talk at PANIC, which I think is a good conference for the times. So we really just finished the first run two searches, and I think that was really a time when we made some serious progress on a lot of the limits on SUSY and exotics. And that's it, we just said limits. So there's some for exotics also, and look for everything from extra dimensions, heavy quarks, lepto quarks, long-lived particles, so there it is. So, so just before that time, there was this nice workshop, I'm sure many of you have been to Treste, where you have the time to have some nice wine, and the weather's nice, and you can think about things a little bit outside the box. And the title of this workshop was Frontiers of New Physics Collider and Beyond, but one of the main themes was, is there anything else that we can look for using the LHC that we're just not looking for now? Some really new search or even new detector that you might be able to install to be able to look for something really interesting. And there was this smart guy there, Ike Yavin, who many of you probably know. And his idea was, how about Millitard particles? The idea simply being that they have low electric charge, and so they deposit very little energy in the detector. So little energy that the LHC detectors would not see that energy being deposited. So they'd basically be invisible to the standard detectors. And is there some new detector that you could add that would be sensitive to these millicharged particles that would be produced at the LHC? So by the end of the evening, actually, we had a basic design of this detector, and the rest is kind of just interesting details. And about a year after that, we had completed a paper which we published, presenting in more quantitative detail the potential for such a detector. One thing we had to think about first is, these are invisible to LHC detectors, but the LHC can see invisible particles, like neutrinos, by the signature of missing energy or missing momentum, missing transverse momentum, more accurately. But we always call it missing energy. The idea being, if you have some balancing jet on one side and just from, say, some initial state radiation, and then you have the visible stuff up on the other side. So if you can tell that that momentum was not visibly conserved, then you can infer the presence of that new signature on the other side. So can we use missing energy to just infer the presence of these millicharged particles which look invisible? The answer is pretty quickly no. We know the search pretty well from the LHC. Looking for, say, invisible Higgs decays, or that's probably the best example at the moment. But lots of other new physics searches looking for something invisible. And the problem is that there's just an irreducible background from Z plus jets where the Z decays to neutrinos way too often. And this plot shows, as a function of the JetPT on the other side, you know, what are the backgrounds that you see, and the rates are huge. I mean, this is an event for 2015-16 data, so 36 inverse femtomarns, and you have, you know, millions of events here of significant JetPT. So, you know, even if it wasn't for the Z, you also have the W, sometimes decays, and it has a very forward lepton, and you can't see it, so it's just hopeless. So the answer is no, and you really do need some new detector to be able to see the missing of the millicharged particles. So there's a long history of searches for millicharged particles, I'll show you a little bit more in a second, but just focusing on this mass range that we're interested in. There was an experiment I'll show you a little bit about from SLAC from 20 years ago, which excluded down to about 10 to the minus 4 E up to 100 MeV in mass. But above that, there's a lot of empty parameter space, unexplored parameter space that we could look for at the LHC, and really only at the LHC, because you need enough energy, center of mass energy, to be able to produce the heavy millicharged particles. And okay, are we really getting down to millicharge? Maybe not quite, although, as I'll show you later, this line is a little pessimistic and probably could exclude down to millicharge around 100 MeV. But the basic idea is we'd be looking for these heavier, say 100 MeV to 100 GeV millicharged particles produced in LHC collisions and then seen in our detector. So they would be produced just via Drellian, but also at lower masses and the decays of hadrons and lots of other nasty things, as I'll show you. The cross section for producing them is basically goes like the charge squared, and also the amount of ionization they deposit goes like charge squared. They deposit energy in the detector just via beta block ionization, and that goes like epsilon squared. So it's a very simple model. It's just two pair-produced millicharge particles. Very simple and model independent other than that. So the basic idea of the detector is that, so if the charge is, say, millicharge, 10 to the minus 3, the charge of an electron, it would look just like a muon in the sense that it's heavy, so it you know, scatter much and all that, but it would deposit 1 millionth of ionization energy in a scintillator detector or anything else that a muon would. So the signals we're looking for are really small energy deposits. The idea would be that you need about a 1 meter long scintillator, like this. And if you have a scintillator this long, then a millicharged particle going through it would leave about one photon on average. And you could therefore look for that photon. Then you put three layers of those back to back, so the millicharged particle would go through all three layers, or maybe four, as I'll show you. And then by looking at coincidence in time, so requiring that photon is seen in all three or four bars in a line, all within the same very short time window, then using that coincidence, you know that you've seen something go through there, and it's very rare to have a different, to have that randomly occur from background noise.
And you assume the particle travels out the speed of light?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what are
or
the,
close enough to it, relativistic.
What are the features in the projected exclusion?
Okay, so I'll show you the production mechanisms here, but basically this is the Z, so Z decays.
Okay.
That's where those turn off at half the Z mass, and then you have half the epsilon mass and half the J psi mass is the main thing. So it's just the virtual photon-like resonances that you have from the Drellian spectrum. But there's also more. There's hadrons and other features that you'll see later. This is the hadron. Um, So as far as the models which could predict this, I mean, like I said, it's model independent. We don't care where the Millichard particles come from, but it is, you know, if you want to convince anybody to give you money for this, you have to, you know, convince them that Millichard particles aren't completely crazy. So there is a nice model, I think, in the hidden sector paradigm, which is a fairly popular idea these days, that you have some dark sector with some new gauge forces and particles in them that interact very weakly with our standard model sector over here. So you can do this, which is the elegant mechanism from Holden, which is in the 60s even, that you just have a new massless dark photon, U1 prime gauge boson, and it has some coupling K, capital. And then if you have some new particles in the dark sector, right, then you can have some mixing between, induced mixing between the standard model and the new hypercharge with this proportionality kappa from this these new fermions running around in that loop thing. Okay, and if you ask Itai, he'll tell you that you can get a kappa naturally on the order of 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 2 just from the masses of that these fermions might have. It's
a loop factor.
It's a loop factor.
Yeah, it's not, the masses actually, these guys can be super heavy. So they can be at the God scale, but their effects still remain because it's irrelevant, it's a marginal operator. So it doesn't depend on the scale of the particle. So even if you, these are by fundamentals under the U1 and U1 prime. I mean, actually it's one of the, yeah, it's very, I mean, and assuming that the couplings are all of the same order in that sector, so then you get the loop factor, which is 10 minus 3 is the magic.
So the word natural is precisely because you're not sensitive to the
matter. No, the natural is because it's a loop factor, so it's 16 pi square, so that gives you naturally a factor of 100 right there, suppression of the mixing. Assuming that the couplings are of the same order between the two sectors, then you get, I mean, the natural assumption is to assume that all couplings are of order one as engage interactions as we measure them. So that's why this is a good target. I mean,
good, thank you.
So he used, yeah, that's a very, you can make it smaller, but it's, yeah.
Okay, so so that kappa then is that you can redefine the gauge field between the mixing of the photon and the dark photon, right? So that you don't write this with a mixed term, but you write it with two terms, and you can then just get a hypercharge for the new dark fermions. The dark fermions have a small amount of standard model hypercharge and vice versa after electrocentric breaking. So the charge, the millicharge of the of the new Millichard fermions, which are these dark fermions, is this kappa times an epsilon prime, and there's a cos theta w for the electroweak symmetry group. Okay, so that's our target. I can mention quickly that this is actually before that. So there's a number of searches, you know, at lower mass for Millichard particles. We're really not talking about any of those, but for Millichard particles, you know, if you look at the literature on Millichard particles, there's been a long history of looking for them in laboratory type environments and also astrophysics and cosmology, which is very interesting, but we're really not attacking that. If you look at this on a big log scale kind of plot, you know, we're looking up here, which is around the GeV to TeV region that we can probe at the LHC. And, you know, that's really interesting because that's where the standard model particles live. So why not the dark particles also? Okay, so that's what we're going after. I do want to mention this slap experiment because it was a really beautiful experiment following with John Jarrett. And his student did this back in 1990s. Yeah, so the idea was you use the pulse electron beam from the positron production source. You make positrons by slamming electrons into a target, and they're pulsed. It's a pulse beam of electrons. So every, microsecond or something, you get a big burst of electrons hitting a target, and then you then look downstream, 110.1 meters downstream through rock for what shows up in long scintillator bars. And if you look at that time that it would take for the particles to get over that distance, then you would expect to see some bump of activity on average in the scintillator like that, but you don't. So you can say that there aren't no charge particles with enough charge to pass the signal criteria, and so it's a nice idea, but it's limited by the center of mass energy of those collisions in terms of mass, which makes you stop at that 100 MeV. I'm sorry, 10. I'll just mention quickly that if I also thought about what happens if you have like a decline in the dark sector, so you could have more complicated SU2, I guess, in the dark sector, and then these Z primes could then be produced and then decay to 2 millicharged particles, and then you'd have a double millicharged particle, boosted thing aimed towards your detector, which is kind of a fun idea. So we explored that, and that's on this slide. We explored that idea, and if you look for these, balancing jets, and you finally came to 2 of them, then we investigated the kind of reach that we would have, and it's also pretty good.
Sorry, it's like a monojet search here that you're using. It's not silicon.
No, so you see both of these in your detector.
Okay.
It's 2 millicharged particles going through your detector at the same time.
And you're still tagging on the jet?
No, so we wouldn't see the jet.
Okay. So you're just looking for psi part and psi.
Yeah, we would just be looking for a pair of millicharged particles.
And why can't you trigger on the jet like this and there? Can you get just that information from the detector, like from CMS nodes?
You mean timing?
Yeah.
So the problem is these jets are really small, maybe it's a 20 GeV jet or something.
So you just throw them out.
So CMS wouldn't have triggered on it.
Actually, CMS now has very small requirements for the jet energy, no? I thought it was
It's probably a few hundred GeV.
Really?
Yeah, it must be. Just the rate is so large. So.
I thought that somebody told me the number, maybe I'm totally misremembering, but that just at the trigger level, they could trigger like down to 10 or 15 GeV. Now, of course, like for analysis, then the cut is really much higher.
Yeah, for a single monojet,
okay.
Right, you would need, that would mean it's really 100. Missing ET triggers, is what it is. And those thresholds are close to 100 GeV.
But why do you need a soft jet? I would expect the jet to be very energetic because you want these two to be quite collinear.
Well, let's say the mass of the Z prime is 10 GeV or something. So, even a 50 GeV jet or something is fairly collinear.
Ah, okay.
But even if CMS did trigger on the jet, right, it would take a bit of coordination for us to take our data set and then go back and see that there was a jet in that bunch collision, that they happen to report.
So
they might trigger on it if it's energetic enough, you're right. And we do have the information to go back offline and say that, we collected this event at this time in this bunch crossing, let's see if you have any data. So it could be possible.
Or you don't do that, even with 1 millicharge.
We don't do that by default. We don't need what they see in a CMS detector in order to see millicharged particles or not. But we, you know, we discussed this with them and, you know, have a plan that if we saw some signal, right, that you would then want to go back and look at what they saw in those events for sure. And maybe you would see something additionally interesting. So in fact, that's some main motivation for why CMS would want to, you know, bother letting them be there in the first place.
But do you like even care at the analysis level in the sense that if it fits in your geometrical acceptance, the efficiency to see the mini charge particle, how much is it? If it's like close to 100%, then you don't care anymore if you trigger on the jet or not. Triggering the jet, right?
Right, we don't need CMS in order to see
right.
The
charge. Right, so maybe you don't really even care.
Well, like I said, if we saw something,
if you saw something,
then it would definitely
right.
be interesting.
Yeah,
to,
but that, the level of putting exclusion.
Right, exactly. Okay, so now there's some details on the experiment. So this is where it is planned to go and where the our initial tests have been carried out, is there's a tunnel which remained from the initial construction of the CMS cabin. So CMS is down here, and that's where the collisions take place. So there's this tunnel, which this is all underground. So this is, you know, a tunnel filled with air, and this is where we can put this detector. It's 33 meters from the interaction point, 17 meters of which is through rock right here. So the angle is, it's basically right over CMS. So this is our collaboration. We're about, you know, six or seven professors, plus we've gotten a lot of help from the engineering staff at CERN and CMS in order to do the technicalities. So as far as the detector idea, like I said, we just want to use long bars of scintillator. And this is kind of a very early sketch of what it might look like. This is the kind of the theorist's idea
of
what the detector would be, right? You take your scintillator bars, you stack them all on top of each other. There's no cables or electronics or anything like that. And you just point it towards the interaction. Okay, but it's not that far off. I mean, you can get order 1,000 of these bars. Each one is 5 by 5 centimeters and 80 centimeters long. Standard plastic scintillator. And these bars are cheap. Each one is $100. We did put some thought into what kinds of other scintillating technologies you could use. And it's kind of interesting that there's not a better solution to this, unfortunately. I'm not sure why, but as you'll see, it's kind of an interesting problem. So what you want is you want a scintillator which is as dense as possible, because the amount of light that you leave is proportional to the density of the material. And you also want a material that gives off a lot of scintillation light for each GeV of energy you deposit. So this is the number of photons you get per kV for things like plastic and sodium iodide. This is lanthanum bromide, doped with cesium, which is a very fancy new scintillator, and liquid xenon, also a nice scintillator. Plastic scintillator is not very, doesn't give you much light, and it's also not very dense, that's why you need a meter and a half long bar in order to get three photons for a Miller charge particle. If you had lanthanum bromide, you could do the same thing in 5 centimeters of it. The problem is that it costs about $3,000 versus $200 for that meter and a half of plastic. The lanthanum bromide is also slightly radioactive, and so I'm not sure CMS wants putting it there, and it would be its own background.
Where does the radioactivity come from?
The cesium, I think.
Mm. Is it cesium or selenium? Sorry, that's not CS, is cesium.
Cesium? Okay, I don't know. Maybe I thought it's cesium. Anyway.
Selenium? Is there such a
thing? That part of the periodic table that people don't usually worry about, that's where that stuff is.
That is
and But it's very expensive, but it's very good. And so, you know, if we can get the cost down, then that would be fantastic. Liquid xenon would also be great. You know, 8 centimeters of liquid xenon would give you just as much light, but it's also pretty expensive, and you need this whole cryogenic apparatus, which is comes with its own expense and hassles. So for now, we've stuck with the plastic, which, you know, it's going to be good enough and it's cheap, and we have a decent amount of space. And a word on the electronics, which really makes this experiment possible, if you want, at least inexpensively. This is, you know, an amazing technical feat that you can read out thousands of channels of photo tubes looking for single photons inexpensively and have excellent timing resolution. It's not so easy to see a single photon. So these boards from Kane, you know, are sampling at 3.2 gigasamples per second, so that's 300 picoseconds per sample. These signals are extremely fast, right? So within, you know, 1 nanosecond, this is what a photon looks like coming from one of these two digitized of these electronics. So, and they also have fantastically low electronic noise. So, you know, seeing a single photon is a very clear event in this experiment. And it has about 1 nanosecond timing resolution for a single photon. These two photons are spread out by a couple nanoseconds because it takes a couple nanoseconds on average for the scintillating state to decay down to the ground state in the scintillators. So the photons themselves come out with a spread in time.
What is the dark rate on these? Is there a...
Well, that's from the photo tubes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it depends on the voltage and blah, blah, blah. It's a few hundred hertz.
Okay. Does it matter how much energy does the response time depend on the energy of the photon, or the amount of energy deposited?
No, that's what's great. I mean, we're seeing each individual photon. So, you know, our time resolution for a single photon is still 1 nanosecond.
But that doesn't depend on the energy.
It doesn't depend on the energy, right? If
yeah.
you have a big pulse, you know, these things add linearly to a very good approximation.
I see.
So if you have a big pulse, you have an even better energy, the time resolution.
Yeah.
Okay, backgrounds. So the 17 meters of rock does remove, you know, all of the hadrons and everything else. We get about 15 muons per minute coming through at you know, standard run-free luminosities. They need about 20 GeV of momentum to make it through the rock. But, you know, that's not a background for us. These are clearly not nullly charged particles. You know, when a muon hits us, it lights up the whole detector. But as you'll see, it can be used for a nice rough check of the alignment and other calibrations. The cosmics are coming in at about 100 times smaller rate than on the surface, but it's still a large rate. It's many hertz of cosmics. It's actually comparable to the collider muon rate. It just happens to work out that at the distance we are and the luminosity we run, we get about the same rate of cosmics and beam muons. The worry is that you have, you know, an active shower in the rocks. If the cosmic comes down, it hits some rock, it creates a lot of electrons and photons, and they just happen to hit three bars that are lined up in a row. And we have simulated that and tested it against data, as you'll see. And then you also just have the random dark pulse background, which is about 100 hertz or so at room temperature. If you cool down the tubes, I did this study with a grad student in the lab, and you cool them down to, temperature goes down in this direction. So if you go down to minus 20 centigrade, which is like Canada temperatures, you get just the
yeah, it's only the winter,
right? So that's you get down to 80 hertz per tube, whereas it's a kilohertz at room temperature. It depends on the tube and the voltage that you're running at. So we did originally think about cooling things down because the probability to get, you know, three dark pulses in a line is not that small if each one is running at a kilohertz. Or you can simply add a fourth layer, which we also are strongly considering now. Okay.
Why? Because cooling down to minus 20, minus 30 would be not enough.
Yeah, it's actually not that easy to cool down a whole experiment to minus 20 or minus 30. I mean,
why don't you? Sorry.
You have to put the whole thing in a big
fridge.
Cold box, and you know, there's condensation, and you've got high voltage from the phototubes. And it's a big volume, right? You can't just buy a refrigerator that big. So it's not impossible, but it's an engineering hassle that you don't want to have to deal with if you don't have to. And we think that adding the fourth layer will just solve the problem. So if the three coincident hits, you just ask for four, and you make the bars a little shorter.
Because the idea is that adding layers will decrease the signal, but also the background, roughly in a similar scale. Right? Because it will be more difficult maybe for, there could be some missed signals, but also
the
background.
The bars are very efficient for the signal. So as soon as you are going to get more than one photon per bar, on average, then you every bar will be very efficient.
Okay.
Quite quickly, it's an exponential turn on for that. But the background is going to be decreased significantly by asking for another coincident hit.
Okay.
So you'll see that. So as far as what the signal can be, so we've simulated this, and it is quite a bit more complicated than we originally thought. So there is the Drellian production, which dominates for higher masses, once you're kind of above the JSI threshold. But for lower masses, it's all the hadronic stuff, which can give you decays. So Dallas decays of, pions and rows and, B hadrons and things like that. They all can give you military particles. Anytime you have something that can give you a virtual photon, basically, that virtual photon can decay to a pair of low charged particles. So it's a huge list of processes, and we've gone through the some grad students with Claudio at UCSB have gone through this exercise of running Pythia, figuring out all the hadrons and what are the branching ratios of the Dallas decays for all these different production mechanisms, and you can see all the a litany of things with omegas. So pions are certainly huge, right? At once the millicharged particle is light enough to be produced in those decays, and you can get up to, we're talking millibar cross sections for these things. And for charge, this goes down like Q squared. So for millicharge, it would be nanobar in cross sections. That's still a huge cross section. Okay, we've also developed a full simulation of the detector in JAINT. So this is kind of what the detector would look like. These things bouncing around are the photons, the scintillation photons that are produced. The military particle is the yellow thing going through here. This is our model of the phototube, which is looking at the scintillator. And we've done things like calibrate on the lab versus our simulation, how many photons do you detect from a muon going straight down and hitting a bar at the end of the bar versus close to the phototube on the bar, and things like that. So we validated the simulation, bouncing these photons off the reflective surface inside. They're wrapped in mylar, the scintillator, so that the photons that are produced bounce around and eventually make it to your phototube. So this is the detector efficiency as a function of the charge. You see, as soon as you're above about 0.0, the turn on is at 0.00236, an exponential turn on of the detector efficiency is a function of charge. So, but it starts to drop off below 0.02. And then I have to show this. So another grad student even made an event display where you can see this is the bars in the the demonstrator that we installed, as I'll show. And if you ask questions like, if I see things in data where I have 1, 2, 3 bars hit in a line, but then I ask 1, 2, 3 bars hit in a line, but then I ask what is causing the signal that I see in a bar off to the side. And you do see correlated signals in a bar off to the side when you have a muon go through 3 bars in a line. And you ask what's causing that, and well, here it is, Jan will tell you. And it's from electrons that are, you know, knocked out of the scintillator and then go in that direction and hit that bar and deposit energy. So this is the number of photoelectrons that you see in that bar. And most of it is caused by electrons, but also electrons scattered off the lead, which is in between here, and all these things. But you can see this is data. This is our measured data for the number of photoelectrons that we see in this bar when you have the signal in those 3 bars. And this is the simulation's prediction of what you should see and where the sources of that are from.
So. Can I ask you something? Could you do this? I mean, the slug, this is a tangent point, but the slug experiment was a beamed up experiment.
Yeah.
So, can you do the same thing in one of these beam dump experiments that people talk about?
Yeah. So, in fact, we talked to the Fermilab people and even wrote a proposal to put a Millikan-like thing behind the NOVA, neutrino.
Yeah, of course, yes.
Right. So, beam dump is you know, you could do it at a beam dump, but you know, at a proton target is really, you know, you have even more, right, where you're like trying to make neutrinos. So yeah, we looked at that, and yeah, you can be quite sensitive. Again, you're just limited by center of mass energy.
Yeah, of course.
So at NOVA, you can get up to about 4 GeV in terms of the millicharged particle mass, which is not bad.
Not bad at all. Can you do, in the coupling, you do similarly?
Yeah, you do similar. You do similar. You can even do a little bit better at low mass. You see, saw how they come from pions. Once the mass is low enough to be made by pions, then it's pretty easy to see these.
What about sheep? Sorry, I'm just the sheep because they're gonna use the SP, right? The SPS beam, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great too. This is always a good thing to do behind a production target. You know, what's good about this is that this exists.
Oh, and I'm all for it. No, don't get me wrong. Just thinking of how much other things you've thought about.
Yeah, SHIP would also do great. We haven't studied in, you know, quantitative detail, but how well that would do. We did it for the Fermilab one. Okay, so there I am in the tunnel. That's the actual tunnel before we put anything in there, and that's where the Millikan is going to go. We built up a demonstrator over the last few years, which would test out this idea and collect data from the LHC collisions before they're over. The LHC is shut down right now, but we had the demonstrator in there for 2018 and collected a lot of data with it. So the idea of what it is, it's got the scintillators and the PMTs. It's only 3 layers of 2x3. That's just what we had lying around in our labs, and we could put this together. So it's about 1% of the cross-sectional area of what Millikan would be. Then we have lead bricks in between, because a lot of the correlated background, correlated in time between the bars, comes from something getting ejected from one of the bars and then straggling off and hitting a neighboring one. So you want lead in between, you know, or even a radioactive decay that gives you 2 photons, right? You want to block the photon, you know, getting to that bar and hitting that bar at the same time. So you just put lead in between, and that does reduce the correlated background. We also added scintillator slabs in between just so we could get some more information about where beam muons or cosmics are coming through the detector. study things. And then we covered the whole thing with simulator sheets on the tops and the sides, so we could tell if a charged particle like a muon is coming in and from the outside and, you know, hitting. So this is like for Vito background research. We would have that on the flow experiment too. Then we also had it on these photoscope packs, which are just smaller granularity, finer granularity simulators, so they let you see kind of a track and higher precision of where the muon went. If you have a beam muon come through here, you can see exactly where it entered the detector and where it exited the detector. So this is good for alignment and, you know, a second cross-check on helping you to understand what's going on in your detector. Okay, so all of this stuff was put together, and we also built the support structure. This was designed by our Lebanese CMS team, and they designed this and we built it at CERN, and it's strong enough to hold the full Millikan detector. It holds up to 6 tons. All right, there's a picture of it. So yeah, it's about 3 meters long. This is in its aligned position pointing towards the CMS interaction point. And there's some grad students hard at work. And
you do the alignment with muons?
I have a slide on that. It's actually amazing. I'll show you.
Okay.
So we ran this thing for basically all of 2018, and we collected 35 inverse temperature barns of data in about 2000 hours. Oh, there's the alignment right here. So yeah, that was one of our challenges. But you know, CERN just has people that come and do this stuff for you with their magic tools. So here's Angie from the alignment team. You know, and she's got this, I think she said it was like 3 million Swiss francs.
This alignment thing,
yeah. She's carrying it around in this, you know, suitcase. but, you know, it's using laser interferometry to measure with sub-micron precision the distance to. So they drill these things into the wall,
yeah.
These little corner cubes that reflect the laser light. And, you know, they have multiple lasers on there and blah, 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 but it's incredibly accurate. And, you know, so she knows where that point is in three-dimensional space with, like, you know, sub-micron precision. And then the challenge, though, is so she knows where CMS is, right? Within the CMS cavern, there's these cubes on the wall at various locations, and they can even monitor how the cavern is moving time and things. But then you need to extend that alignment coordinate system through the tunnel, all the way over here to where Millikan's going to be. So each of these dots is where she put a laser cube, and then from any point you can see two other points, and that's all you need. And then you can extrapolate that coordinate system as far as you want. Now systematic errors add up, and you know, I asked her about this, and I was afraid she wasn't going to know what I was saying. But she's well aware of that. And, you know, it's all in the software. And, you know, it's the errors are propagated correctly.
How long did it take her?
About a week. It took them about a week to go through this and
do everything.
Yeah.
Did you have to correct? I guess you can do it with the muons, as you were saying, afterwards. Did you correct afterwards?
We checked. She claims that she knows that we're aimed at the IP, so that if you drew a line through us, that line would hit the IP within about a millimeter.
Oh my God.
30 meters away.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So I think that she's much better than us. But you know, my worry is not that she's wrong about a millimeter or a centimeter, but that the beam is actually like that way. You know, she's off by like, you know, a sign or something like that, is what I worry about. But so we can check this, right? So just let's see if we can see muons coming through our detector. So this is Muons coming through our detector, the number, the rate of muons per hour, and these are dates down here in 2018, and this is when the luminosity was delivered, right? The luminosity comes in fills each day, and so you can see that they do line up, and the periods where the beam was off, and you know, we don't see muons, and we do, we do. And so you can even see that starting from the time of a fill, we see, you know, more muons at the beginning of a fill when the luminosity is higher than at the end of the fill when the luminosity is lower, right? The beam collision rate decays as the beams become wider and photons are lost. Okay, so we can actually measure the luminosity of LHC collisions. And does the rate agree with our simulated predictions for how many muons we should see? So where do muons come from in LHC collisions? Well, they come from QCD and mainly Bs and Cs, and maybe some Ws and Zs in them. So if you do that simulation, just using standard CMS simulation, and then you account for the energy loss of those muons getting through the rock, then you can figure out how many muons we should see. So we measured a rate of 0.19 muons per inverse picobar. And the expected from the simulation is 0.28 plus or minus 0.09. So, you know, we're within a signal. It's pretty close. And this doesn't account for scattering. A lot of these are low energy muons, because the ones that happen to get through to you are the stragglers at the bottom of the energy spectrum. So it's a little bit of a tricky thing. So I expect that that will get even better once we account for that. But we're definitely seeing muons at the right rate. And if you look at, you know, what angle are the muons coming through the detector, right? Are they hitting this far in a straight line, as you would expect them to if your detector is aligned correctly? Or are they going through kind of sideways or, you know, top to bottom and all that? So if you look at these different categories of which bars the muons hit, then this is what you would simulate if it's aligned correctly, and this is what the data shows. So it's excellent agreement, and we're aligned as well as we can tell with perfectly.
And this was even the cells were even smaller, right? The bars were 2 times 3. You have even larger bars, right?
So the bars are 5 by 5.
But you're already using the 5 by 5.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Mm-hmm. I thought it was more. Yeah.
There's 2 by 3 layers.
So layers, not, but the bars are the same size. Okay.
Right. Okay, we can also look at timing resolution. So, you know, how often do you, if the muon's going this way, then the ones that are in time from the beam should be centered at zero if you, you know, calibrate your tubes so that zero means in time, right? But the ones that are going the wrong way, say from cosmics and coming through your detector backwards, should be 15 nanoseconds out of time because it's going backwards. And that's the length of, you know, just times the speed of light, and it's gotta go basically a factor of 2 because instead of going forward, it's going back. So they're 15 nanoseconds out of time, and we can see that. So we can measure a nice resolution of about 4 nanoseconds for these cosmic events. And we've always been talking about using a 15 nanosecond timing window to select our signal events. So our resolution is more than good enough to justify that time. Right. So how would you search for these things? To do a search, you need 2 things, right? You need to know what the background is and what the signal is. So we have the signal simulated, but for the background, you need to say what is the background for these straight muon paths that nil charged particles would take. What we can do is we can do this as a function of the number of photoelectrons, how big the signal is in each bar. We can have pointing paths, which are the signal light region, that's A, and these are the in-time ones. But you also have the out of time ones. So the you know, if it's just random background and a random combination of, say, you know, a radioactive decay here and some noise burst over there, they're not going to be in time for any particular reason. They'll happen at random time intervals. So these out of time kind of backgrounds are down here. And then you also have pointing and non-pointing paths. You have, you know, the signal, the Millichard particles would go straight through 1, 2, 3, but the other backgrounds would just be, you know, a bar over here and a bar over here, or maybe a bar to the side next to it and a bar next to it. So it wouldn't just be the pointing paths. So we have these two variables, the pointingness and the in-timeness, and you can do an ABCD method technique where you're just saying that the ratio of the in-timeness is the same whether it's pointing or not. And you say the ratio of the pointingness is the same whether it's in time or not. So going either way across these axes, you have a constant factor. And so you can say that the number of signal is the number that you see here in B times the measurement of that factor in the C and D region. Okay, so so you can make a prediction using, you also have the fact that sometimes the beam is on and sometimes it's off. And you should only see signal when the beam is on and background whether it's on or off. So you can make the prediction of the number that you see in A as a function of the size of the signal in each bar. Using either beam data or off-beam data. And if you look at the observation of how many you see compared to what you predict, it's in very good agreement when the observation is made with the no-beam data. We haven't looked yet at the straight line paths in this region with the beam on data, because you only do that once you're very sure that your analysis is ready to go, which we're very close to. Okay, so we have a good way of understanding the background, and we believe we even understand where some of it, where most of it comes from in the different types of background, but we can measure the rates of it in data, which is even better. All right, so if we have some idea of our background and we know how much signal we're going to get, then we can start to estimate our sensitivity. So this I showed you before. These are our very old estimates, basically from our original paper, which are still pretty valid for what you would expect to do with a full-size Millikan, either in 300 m per snuff front, so that would be run 3, or you know, high luminosity, I would see, you know, by 20. 35 or something. Okay, but this is what we think we can do with our demonstrator that we've already installed and collected our 35 inverse femtobarns with. So these three different lines, this is, you know, assuming that the background is big enough so that you would need to require either 5, 10, or 20 events of signal in order to have a high enough significance of the exclusion, right? So if your background is small, then you would only need 5 events to claim exclusion, right?
Yeah, can I add, why isn't your curve just a scale-up version of the, I mean, the center of mass energy that you have is roughly the same. This is with 13 TeV, right? Center of mass, the data that you took?
Yeah.
So then why isn't it just a scaled back up version of the black or the blue line, with because you have different coverage.
Well, a couple things have changed. So this was with a somewhat older signal simulation. It was only the Drellian and the epsilons and the J size, and some slightly different assumptions were made for the J size. So we didn't realize that the low PTJ size are actually a significant source of the signal.
I see. So those were so the big step there is the J psi
Yeah, the J sites really helped you a lot. And we didn't realize that originally. But yeah, I mean, if it was the same simulation, then.
Then it would just scale up by the square root of the size.
Yeah, it should, basically. It might look a little funny on a log plot, too.
No, of course, but it's, I mean, the sensitivity in epsilon is the square root of the coverage, right?
Kind of. I mean, when you get to here, then, well, you still are talking about, you're talking about low numbers of events, too, so I'm not sure it scales exactly that simply.
Yeah.
Because you always need to see enough, enough events.
No, but still, you get hit by a lot by the J-psi thing. What is J-psi, by the way? Except one, two, right?
These are the J-psi.
Yeah.
So it's the half of J-psi
so
mass.
You get hit, yeah, you get hit by a factor of 10, basically, in the couple.
Yeah. Yeah, the cross-section really jumps up in the J-psi's.
The blue.
Bam.
Yeah.
There, yeah, it's significant.
I see.
So we've checked this pretty carefully.
Yeah.
We've even validated this against Tevatron and CMS data, and there's theoretical uncertainties in here. So we have about a factor of two uncertainty, but that's negligible on that log plot.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you want to make our millicharge particle does not have to have high PT to make it to us. It doesn't lose much energy in the rock. And so even a 1 GB PT millicharge particle will be fine for us. And so you need to worry about JSI that are made with, 2 GB of PT. There's a lot of them. Yeah. Originally, we just had PT greater than 6.5 GV on our JSI. So yeah, the simulation has been significantly improved. But yeah, other than that. So yeah, assuming that our background is low, which we believe it will be, as you saw in the last slide, then we can exclude things. Just if you have 5 signal events or something, then we can start to exclude. Now, if you go down too low, say below about 0.01, we're going to have some cutoff here just because we have too few photon scenes. So the photo tubes that we used in the demonstrator are not the fancy high-gain tubes that you would use for that actual experiment. These were sitting around our labs, from the 70s and 80s. Every high-energy physics lab has these sitting around, and they're not, there are special tubes that are designed for these single photon observations, and they have more stages of amplification. These more standard tubes, you're not able to do that. So. Right around here, we're going to have some cutoff due to just not having. But that's still pretty good. I mean, we're excluding, some new parameter space here, or we could even see something in this new parameter space below, even all the previous collider limits, and, this thing costs order nothing. So it was a bit of work. much time. All right, I just have a couple more slides. So one main thing we did learn from this, though, is that especially if you want to go down to low number of photoelectrons, very small energy deposits, right, as shown here. So this is as a function of the size of the energy deposit. So your single photon. Right here, here you're saying that there's 200 events where you have 3 bars in a row with at least one photoelectron seen. So that's too much, right? You don't want to have 100 events in the background. So what do you do about that? So if you really want to worry about going to low charge, then we think we need to add a fourth layer. And so we tried this out. We actually added, we turned it flat so that we had more space, and we don't care about seeing anything from the beam. We just want to measure the background. So we turned it flat, and we put a fourth bar behind one of them, behind the old demonstrator, as you can see here. And then we made estimates and measurements of what the background rate is for if you ask for also a hit in that fourth bar within the same time window. And here you can see it. So it's about a factor of 300 lower for adding that fourth layer. And so this is, you know, 2-fold coincidence, 3-fold coincidence, 4-fold coincidence. This is the observed rate. This is the predicted rate if you just assume random coincidence. So if the backgrounds are not just random overlaps of random things. There are actual physics processes which produce hits in two or more bars at the same time. And that is the majority of that. Like, you know, a cosmic come in and hit multiple things. But that's the observed rate, and it's factor of 300 lower. So so that, we think, will be the best way to go and will allow us to push to the low charges. You look confused.
I'm just like thinking. So there are lots of things that come to mind that you could look for in addition to miniature. So, well, I have first a couple of very naive questions. First of all, like, assume that you had lots of mini-charged particles just around, say that they are dark, 0.1% of dark matter or a percent of dark matter. They have very low velocity, but they will hit your detector, and your detector has very low threshold. Will you be able to see that? So the so just a 10 GeV guy is just...
I don't know. I mean, eventually they will stop, right?
They will stop, that's true, on the rock.
Because dx is when you have relativistic particles, dx is smaller. The moment particles are non-relativistic, they're easier to stop.
So a particle with epsilon 10 to the minus 3 or something, these guys are able to see, will it stop in the rock before getting to the detector or not?
I don't think they can get through the atmosphere.
Yeah.
The 10 to the minus 3 one? Okay.
Yeah, because it goes like 1 over b to the 4th rate of energy loss.
Okay,
so the point, so V of 10 to the minus 3, you're like basically
really
crawling.
Right.
So,
you don't make it through the atmosphere, you say.
No, I don't think
even
so.
10 to the minus 3.
And there have been other more sensitive experiments to low ionization already, like xenon 100.
Yeah.
Xenon 100 has already the same. I mean, you may have less rock above you than xenon 100.
Okay, but they did some tests, you know, on the surface too, right? And they didn't see.
That's true.
They didn't see signals coming through. Understand.
I thought though also, so dark matter. So at those masses, though, there is also constraints from self-interaction because those large charges.
That's true. It's a long range.
Yeah. So then you would have.
But this is sorry. But I'm thinking like percent of dark matter. So in that case, there are no constraints. It cannot be 100% of dark matter, right?
Sure.
But it doesn't make it to the detector. What about dark photons? Like just so not massless, but massive dark photons that you produce somehow at least 10 GeV guy makes it to your detector. It will be like a photon, but with a smaller interaction with electrons. So it naively can kick out an electron out of your detector. So a dark photon.
That's a good question.
You make a dark photon in DLHC somehow. Say that it has 10 GeVs, it goes to your detector, it knocks out something, like an electron from an atom or something.
But I thought dark photons have no interaction with the standard model particles.
No, if you assume here that it's massless,
yes.
If it's massive, then that changes the picture. Because basically you fix the moment you add dark photon a mass, you fix the basis, so the ability that you have in the original Holdom thing to rotate away the mixing is no longer there.
Right.
So in principle, you do have a gap in this proportion to the mass, but the effects.
Yeah, so I was just looking at the bounds on dark photons on those masses. Like, you can go up to pretty high masses. The bounds, they come from Babar and Bell, but they are not stronger than the numbers that you are showing here, epsilon of 10 to the minus 3. So, naively...
Yeah, so I don't know what how much ionization... I don't know how much energy they lose.
It's just like literally like a standard model photon with the only difference that it's like 10 GeV or something and a reduced charge, effective charge.
Okay.
It's not clear. Probably, you know what will happen? It will convert to 2 electrons inside your detector.
You will have also
it's not going to be because it's not charged, right? So what you will see happen in your detector. So maybe... Yeah, so you just convert to a plus and minus to a plus and minus pair.
Right. But the signal will maybe look different to what
they will look like, it will be like things that, well, the plus and minus will be pretty collimated.
It will be collimated, but it will bump.
Maybe I'll start bouncing out and you may be rejecting it right now because you have this.
But those electrons also will convert to photons finally, the electron photon conversion. I don't know how much does an electron travel in your detector before turning into a photon.
But here, they're going to be, actually here, all the center of mass of the dark photon is converted into plus and minus. In what you're looking now, you just have a relativistic particle that still goes through the entire detector and most of the energy is taken away.
Right.
Here you would be looking for something that just drops all its energy inside the detector.
It would be a big bang.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but so by the way, that model is equally as simple as the milli-charge model that you have. It's
sure,
like super simplified and...
So
we wouldn't be looking for dark photon decays, we'd be looking for dark photon...
Interacting somehow with your detector, right?
Right. So you're sensitive to a much longer lived dark photon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, those,
I mean, many of them are very hard to do with, that's why they design, some of the beamed up experiments are designed exactly for that. You have produced the dark photon, then it gets converted to E plus and minus, and then you measure the E plus and minus.
Right.
That's the second thing that I will look at. And the third thing that I will look at is that, again, like something that is a bit long-lived and interacts in your detector, not via like electric force, but for instance, via Yukawa forces, like action light particles, or like new scalars, popping steam quarks.
Oops.
Those guys also will interact now with your nuclei in your detector. They will shake off your nucleus. Once you shake it off, that will shake off an electron.
That would be even smaller DDX though, because one of the reasons you get one of the V to the fourth is because ENM is a long range interaction. So when you go through, if you have a point particle that goes through material, for most of the time it's like empty space. So that's why DDX has 1 over V to the 4th dependence, because ENM is a long-range interaction. Maybe you can add a scalar with a nucleus and then you get things like that. Now it starts getting a bit too... The dark photon thing, I think it's...
No, of course, I'm just like...
By the way, this is a great idea, and you guys have done a lot by just scraps that you had in your... So the question is, can you do more?
Yeah, I mean, I think the more we can find more kind of theories we can attack and the more kinds of possibilities...
Yeah, I agree with that.
Certainly the better.
The dark photon thought is a good one. I don't know...
And we can constrain that one because it's 20 meters is a baseline different from other...
So that's something that you will need to calculate, like to compare with other.
It will need to be compared with other background things,
right?
Because now the signal that you have is completely different. You don't look at small energy deposition.
One will need to calculate the boost of the photon, dark photon, because it needs to get to milliken. To millican.
Yeah.
So you will need to.
That part I'm not so worried about. I'm more worried about if you require that it reaches there, does it produce? Is it something that you won't throw out of there?
Right. Also,
you have like dark photon to normal photon conversion.
That's true in a background, in a medium that can happen. In free space, that cannot happen.
Yeah, we're not in a strong magnetic field out there.
But Well, it can go by close to a nucleus or something, but that's the equivalent of astronomy.
Yeah, it will be.
Okay, so I'll definitely look into trying to understand what the dark photon signature is.
Yeah, because I think if you guys, I will help with your funding too. So I really like this idea. This is so nice.
Great.
Anyway.
Yeah. So
yeah. So
I'm almost done, but like you say, we've done a lot so far, and we even have a design for what the full detector would look. This is a more experimentalist, realistic view of what the detector would in the end look like. But you know, you need things to kind of hold the bars together and hold them aligned, and where you're going to run the cables and put things together. And these are modules that we would then assemble on the surface and then bring down. And then we have this cage, we call it, that would attach to the support, which we built. And then you lay it flat and you slide the modules one by one into the cage. And you can bring them in and out individually if you want to fix something, and you don't have to take everything apart. So it's a very nice modular design, which is cost effective and easy to build, and you know, the whole thing is very useful. So the plan, you know, we're basically ready to build now, as soon as we get some money to do so. And the demonstrator was installed here. We collected data in 2018, and then we've been shut down. We're here now, and we could be building, and then we could collect data whenever we want in run three. One nice thing is that we've convinced CMS to pay for moving the door to the tunnel. So before, you had to turn off the LHC to go in the tunnel because it was behind. Otherwise, you could just walk down into the detector when the beam is on. But now they've moved the door behind at the other end of the tunnel. So now you can go into the tunnel when the beam is on. And the background radiation is only about 10 times like what it is in this room. But so we can work on it whenever we want. So we can, you know, be building anytime during here and start collecting data during run three with no problem. And then there's the long shutdown, and then, you know, we have a long time to collect data during HLOHC. That's roughly the plan.
Yeah.
So that's about it. I mean, like you've already figured out, more generally, Millikan is the first detector sensitive to small ionization, really a single ionization photon, so a few EV, at the LHC or any collider that I'm aware of. Its energy threshold is about 100 EV. I have this in for you. It's potentially sensitive to other signals and models as well. People have thought about this. People have thought about dipoles or things related to heavy neutrinos.
Have they thought about quirks?
Quirks, but quirks are highly ionized, right? If it's charged.
No, that's true. That's true.
So I don't know, but probably a more fancy model of a quirk.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Millie quirk.
Millie quirk. Exactly.
Okay. So you know, Millikan is moving forward. We have a lot installed down there already. We've already recorded a lot of data, and we're working on this analysis right now, and it really may be sensitive to physics soon, and we're attracting funding. And it's really been a lot of fun to work on this small collaboration, you know, being someone that grew up on D0 at the Tevatron, you know, that was already 500 people or something. Doing something small with 10 people is really fun, and I learned a lot. All right, well, thank you.
Thank you. It's cool. Yeah, it's true. I forget you were in D0. That's when I first met you, I think.
Yeah,
I was still a student.
Long time.
Yeah. Oh well.
When did D0 stop? I think that by the time I was a student, it wasn't really.
So I mean, I was doing Higgs searches there in 2008 and 10. And it really didn't. Well, it still exists.
Right.
You know. So, not too much physics comes out of it. Past when the Higgs started getting excited at the LHC, I think.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Great.
Thank you.
No more questions. Thanks again, Andy, for coming.
Yeah, we don't have to clap, we can come. It's just like...
But I feel weird.